Right the way through, we're now going to try and move the discussion on somewhat. Effectively, we've covered the areas of the economic logics of migration, the community consequences of migration, and the political debate around migration over the three core sessions of the day, and the consequence of the very rapid changes we've seen in London over the last few decades. And I suppose all of those have discussions earlier on have generated both analytical perspectives with arguments to varying degrees esoteric or central to those things that make sense to all of us about what are the benefits of migration economically, how do we actually balance the costs and benefits, but also how does that turn into politics around the subject of migration. But one of the things that we do know is that analytical landscape is also crisscrossed with a series of normative discussions. Migration is frequently the subject of highly emotive debate. How we actually manage to reconcile emotions held in good faith as well as those peddled less faithfully, if you like, alongside an analytical debate is a real challenge. So the organisers thought, I think, that it would be a good idea to actually have a final discussion session, which tried to ask the question: How can we have a rational debate about migration in the public domain? One that doesn't shy away from the difficult questions, but also translates some of the more erudite or esoteric elements of academic argument into a more convincing or communicable form. And so, I think we're very lucky today to have Karen Buck MP and Trevor Phillips, both of whom have been involved at various forms of politics as well as other forms of public life. And they're going to just kind of kick us off. But the idea is these are not presentations as such, but to try and have a discussion around the room. So I'll be trying to kind of G up some contributions from all of you through the time. But to kick us off, we're going to start with Trevor. So Trevor.
Thank you very much, Michael. And it's all slightly daunting to be in a room full of people who study and know stuff. I'm just basically a journalist, though in latter life I have become what my friends in the finance industry call a quant, for the absence of doubt, that is Q-U-A-N-T, because I think that one of our problems in discussing this, as in so many other areas of public life, is that in latter years, I think we've become slightly over-Freudian in our approach to things, much more concerned with supposed motivation and so on, and not enough, in my view, about what people actually do, what their actual behaviour tells us. So in what I want to say in these 3 or 4 minutes, I lean pretty heavily on work that I do with a little team, which is, and we are completely obsessed with questions like transactions, behaviours, interactions that run into the hundreds or thousands or millions. So we worry about why some groups of people, by, for example, by ethnicity, if you want to sell them cars, paint them green, and I will tell you which group it is if you are ready to pay the money for it. So let me start this way. Why is it so difficult? Where does rationality go out of the door? Well, let me start with two things. First of all, which are to do with the landscape. When we're thinking about immigration, I've just come back from a session on the continent with a lot of other people who are discussing what we all now know about the nature of migration and its measurement. One of our big problems, certainly in this country, is that we still have a narrative about immigration which really belongs to the 1970s and the 1980s. The typical notion of the immigrant is poor, economically driven, one shot, south to north. Actually, the truth of the matter, and by the way, London is possibly the most extreme example of the change, is that immigration today is circular. It is more rich, actually, in some parts, and certainly in the city, than it is poor. It is in highly skilled, and that is changing a whole series of other factors. And it comes from a much wider range of origins than previously. So the conversation that we have tends to be about a kind of migration which almost expired 10 years ago. It's one reason why conversation doesn't always match up with reality. Secondly, the differentiation of different settled groups, second and third generation, is in this country becoming clearer and clearer. Mm-hmm. And there are probably two areas in which you can see that spectacularly. One is in crime, behavior of gangs, differentiation. In this city, one of the things that the Metropolitan Police will show you, if you are privileged enough to discover it, to be shown it, is the way in which organized, so-called, crime in this city is divvied up between different ethnic groups. Same is true about gangs and so on. And the other is the spectacular impact of some ethnic groups on the educational performance of London, which of course has now become an international success story, and which bureaucrats like us tend to attribute to our far-sightedness and the London Challenge and our cleverness in swapping teachers and all the rest of it. But if you plot the changes against concentrations of ethnic groups, you couldn't get, it would be hard to get a better correlation. And actually, by the way, there are interesting intervening variables. Biggest leap in performance, Northwest London, Harrow. Is that because it's Hindus, or is it because marriage in that area, 80% plus, which as we all know is another correlate for success in educational performance, is what's happening there? We don't know. But these are things that we've got to get to grips with if we really want to have a proper conversation about immigration. So that's about the landscape. Second area which perhaps gets in between us and proper conversation is a typical basic problem about public discourse, certainly in this country, and that is the failure to distinguish the individual from the aggregate, which is why you get now the famous Ipsos Mori numbers that tell you nobody cares very much, nobody's particularly disturbed by immigration on their street, but they think it's a massive problem nationally. Well, actually, and this is now used typically as a way of dishing the people who are anti-immigration, actually I think that's not quite right. I think what this actually demonstrates is the difference between impacts in terms of individual impacts and the effect of aggregate. And the public is not stupid. They don't hate immigrants, but for example, they do understand the significance of the increase in population on infrastructure. Secondly, and you know, the simplest way of describing this is, you know, my necessity to get to work is your traffic jam. Secondly, there is a big problem in politics in recognizing the significance of culture on choice as opposed to economic standing, and that is why, for example, though it is perfectly legitimate for the opposition currently to say that their plan, their policy on immigration is first apologize because we've got the numbers wrong, and secondly we're going to do something about exploitation and all the rest of it. Perfectly legitimate positions, and by the way, positions that the public likes, but positions that have actually no traction on their support for UKIP. Why? Because their view about immigration is not economically driven. It's a cultural issue, which is why, for example, when Mr. Nigel Farage uses an iconic cultural image, who's speaking what in the train, it's stupid to attack him for being a racist, because actually what you're really saying to about 30 million people is your feeling of discomfort is somehow racist, and these people do not think of themselves as racist, and for what it's worth, my opinion is hardly any of them probably will be. So there's an issue for the political elite about the way we understand this. Third big issue is urban versus rural, completely different impacts. And I don't need in this gathering, I think, to go on about that. Fourthly, there's a kind of a question of which in politics now, of which immigration is probably the best example, which is to do with the potency of government or its lack thereof. Laura McLaren at Glasgow has done some fantastic work, which in summary demonstrates that the big thing about immigration is that it is the symbol for voters of government's inability to do what they say they're going to do. It's an immigration salience is not really as much about immigration as it is about trust. And why this is important is that if we're going to have a public debate, then we have to be kind of honest with the public that here's a problem which looks where immigration is inevitable. Everybody knows that because of aging and all the rest of it. But the problems that come with it appear to be intractable. But we keep promising, we political media elite, keep promising people that we're going to fix it. And actually, we don't. So it seems to me that that is one the fourth reason for a problem with debate. Now, very quickly, London is, I think, a special case because it's the extreme end and there are issues to do with history. But I want to just pick up 2 points specifically about London. One is demographics. We are now 40% immigrant minority in London. We are heading to a place where the majority, certainly in inner London, will be a visible minority in our lifetime. That changes all kinds of things. And it changes the things for this reason, which we do not sometimes understand. I think we're not we don't understand, but we're not taking account of enough in this country in social science in the way they are in France, where they think, where they're now beginning to talk class more as a taste, a question of taste rather than occupation. The influence of inheritance, of culture, of environment is incredibly important. We did some work about 2 months ago, which looked at the influence, the significance amongst minority communities of living in a cluster or out of a cluster being a postcode in which they're more than 30% non-white. And the difference shows up most markedly in support for Labour. The difference is about 12%. 60% minorities in clusters vote Labour, 48% outside clusters. Now, there's all sorts of arguments about what that really means. Does it mean that people who are less Labour inclined are more likely to move out of the cluster or not? But the basic point is that I think that there's some clear evidence that environment makes a substantial difference. This is going to, and I came in at the end of an interesting discussion, I think, about politics. Here are some just quick facts. By the middle of this century, more than half of the people who vote Labour will be non-white in this country. Secondly, we thought about May 22nd. There was a lot of talk about how London didn't vote UKIP because it was more socially liberal and all that. Completely not true. When you crunch the numbers, what you discover is 2/3 of minorities voted Labour, 2/3 of whites in this city voted Tory or UKIP. Very, very different story indeed. This, I think, I heard the discussion about Conservatives. I think that there is an issue for Conservatives as there for the Republicans, but actually, I think there's a bigger issue for the left. And that, to some extent, the Americans have factored it, they've priced this into their politics already, but it's something we're not used to. What happens when a potential party of government depends on minorities, ethnic minorities, for its core vote? That is what will happen somewhere between 2030 and 2045 in this country. And that's quite a big issue for the Labour Party. We hear a lot from the northern white heartlands and all of that, which in my view is where the party was, perhaps not enough from where the party is going. I've got a couple of points which might interest people about who has been successful in dealing with this issue politically, and they are the Canadians and the Germans. Just a fact about Canadians, Canadian Conservatives 12 years ago, 9% of their votes was immigrant, 3 years ago, that figure was 31%. There are more immigrants represented by Conservative members of Parliament in Canada than by any other party. Last point, and this is a big issue for London, I think, is that because of the different nature of immigration, now, as I started out speaking about, there's a really big issue for cities like London. That's an issue about, not about immigration being difficult because it clogged up the train or because people don't like blackface. It's entirely to do with inequality. A senior official in Barcelona told me that one of the biggest issues they'd had in the last year or so, city argument, had been the fact that someone, an Indian tycoon, had had a wedding for his daughter. And they could pay for whatever they wanted, so they paid for to take over a local park and one of the palaces. Absolute uproar in Barcelona. It's created a big, big issue. By the way, I can tell you who it is. It's Lakshmi Mittal, so it's a Brit. My point about this is that we have benefited enormously in this city from immigration. But one of the byproducts has been the emergence of a superclass, wealthy, and by the way, an underclass of very poor people. And the speed and the depth and the significance of immigration in the city is inextricably linked with the growth of that inequality. And that is something for which people who, like me, believe that immigration is good for our society, are basically got to suck up and work out what we do about it. Because actually, it is probably going to be the deepest problem that affects us politically and in terms of public debate over the next 10 to 12 years.
Thank you. Karen.
Thanks very much. My constituency, Westminster North, has always been, in common with parts of the East End, an area of arrival. It was built, in fact, on the back of the Paddington Railways, the expansion of the railways, and it was an Irish community. It became one of the areas of arrival from the Caribbean after World War II, and it has been, in the last 15 years, an area of arrival, particularly for people from North Africa and from the Middle East, so that Arabic is now the second language. But it is also, not uniquely in London, but at the very high end of the hyper-diversity. And I think, kind of echoing a point that Trevor made, and something that you may have been discussing during the course of the day, there is a great deal of difference between hyper-diversity and diversity. There is a lot of difference between communities where two different communities, as sometimes the case in parts of the northern towns, are living beside each other, and areas where you will have 100 different languages, 120 different languages spoken in the secondary schools. And I have a constituency where we have 120 languages spoken, and I struggle to even count the number of communities where we have Muslims coming from. Just to reinforce a point that Trevor made, that what is so much of the debate is based on a concept of immigration and ethnicity, and doesn't get beneath the extraordinary diversity behind that, and the very, very different issues and concerns and backgrounds from that come from people from such a wide diversity. Now, I think the two great themes of the day are around competition and change, and I think for London in particular, the issue of competition, people filter so much of the immigration debate through, is around the issue of housing. And it is, again, echoing something Trevor said, I think there are two strands within this that are particularly important. The first is the recent tendency, or accelerated tendency, towards the luxury housing development, which is whether or not this is entirely dominated by properties that are sold off plan in Malaysia and Singapore, in a sense, doesn't matter. I mean, the fact is that significant portions of our new housing in so many parts of central London are widely perceived to be beyond the reach of anywhere that people can live, or are owned or let on behalf of international owners at the high end of the market. And the student housing market, I'd say, is a particularly kind of sharp example of that, which is driving part of what's going on in the housing market. And I think that certainly when the debate takes place within my constituency, and incidentally it's a debate that happens within and between minority communities and recent migrants as much as it does between white residents and black and minority ethnic communities, it is the exceptional pressure on housing and the sense that housing developments are being driven for somebody else that is a particularly strong element for them. But the other sharp end of this, and I think this is I find a particularly fascinating debate, is around the competition for affordable and social housing. And the fact that we have now lost in my borough 45% of all the property that used to belong to the local authority. And that property, this is interesting in several ways, because not only does it mean that the competition for affordable housing is so much more acute than it was 30 years ago, even if the total inflow hasn't changed very much, what also happens is something extraordinary, which I think kind of filters into the change agenda as well. The property that was lost to social housing through Right to Buy has entered the private rented market almost exclusively. Few exceptions to that. Pimlico hasn't. They were advertising in certainly City West Homes an ex-Right to Buy property on Pimlico for £690,000 this week, which had just been let at £500 a week, and so it's now being sold. But this high end, it's not just the loss of the total housing stock and where that goes. It's also something that fuels a great deal of unhappiness within communities, which is people no longer know. They look at a local authority block, they look at the Mozart estate, the Warwick estate, the Church Street estate, and they say, how's that family got that house? How's that person got that house? How are these two young men working in working in the restaurant trade got this house? And they do not know that those properties are no longer run by the local authority. And this total lack of why should they? Why should they know this? But the fact that this competition is then the changing competition agendas feed off each other. People are in competition for a house that they don't get. They see people getting property that they do not believe are entitled to, and indeed they wouldn't be entitled to, and indeed they're not in local authority housing at all. So this is something that causes people a lot of anxiety. But also, running off from the housing agenda, and I'm sorry if you heard a lot of this before, but the escalation of the private rented sector over the period since about 2003-04 has created a different element to the change agenda, because it is injected into diversity and new arrival hypermobility. And hypermobility is, in my view, a very damaging thing. Now, we all know the private rented sector it's essential we have a healthy private rented sector. It's very good for underpinning the labour market. I mean, no successful city would ever not have a strong private rental market. But it is toxically undermining to stable communities. And a degree of stability at the same time as communities becoming more diverse is absolutely critical. And I think we spend a lot of time chasing running up the down escalator in communities with high levels of diversity, trying to kind of inject some sense of stability and neighbourliness into them, undermined by what's happening with the private rental sector, which has grown very fast as well. So I think that's another set of issues. But I don't want to speak too long, so let me just kind of end really by saying something about a very positive agenda as well, because I think there is a lot to be very positive about. Speaking as a politician, I have to say that the agendas that come to me from one of the most diverse communities on earth are indistinguishable. If I close my eyes and sit in my advice surgeries or go out into the events where I meet the community, I have not the slightest idea who is coming to me to complain about car parking, rubbish collection, and what schools their kids can get into. And I think this is all critically important as well, because there is this sense, I think, that you know that newer arrival communities, or black and minority ethnic communities, which are often conflated, have different sets of agendas and different sets of priorities, and on a day-to-day level, they absolutely don't. So I think that's very important. I think it's very important that we recognise in this debate just what's happened in schools. I think Trevor touched upon it as well, and the London school transformation success, I think, tells us something very, very important about what institutions can do to manage diversity and to challenge some of the ingrained view that, for example, newer arrivals and minority ethnic communities always equated with disadvantage, and particularly with educational underachievement. We know historically there have been many strands of that, and we understand why, but it isn't it is absolutely not not necessarily the case. And also we know from research, and I know from my own experience, that our diverse communities participate in institutions in a very active way. And obviously I see that very, very much through having a large and diverse Muslim population, involvement in mosques. But that comes out into a strong and healthy both interfaith and also community engagement. And I do think that one of the lessons that we have to learn from this, which I think has been a bit undermined, if I can inject a touch of politics, by the last 3 or 4 years, is the fact that some of the institutions that have been very helpful in helping us manage that process of community and neighbourhood building, which is so important, are the ones that have been most undermined. And I think, you know, particularly two examples: local government as a whole, because local government can play such a constructive role in different ways, and not necessarily by spending large amounts of money, but by the kind of neighbourhood development work that we were seeing, you know, reasonable degrees of success in a number of areas. And then one that is particularly dear to my heart, which was the Sure Start programme, which was a fantastic way of bringing together a very, very diverse group of parents and children in the interest and solidarity of their children. And it was a very, very good way of building relationships. So I'm just going to end with this one anecdote, which is challenging some of the negatives. It's particularly on the back of the Trojan horse story of the last few weeks. I go into schools a lot. I do quite a lot of political, but sort of civic engagement and education with secondary schools. And they asked me to go in and chair a debate in a secondary school in my constituency, which is overwhelmingly attended by Muslim pupils. So very, very diverse backgrounds, and mostly relatively recent arrivals. And when I got there, I found that the debate that they chose, and this was 6 or 8 months ago, was should gay marriage be allowed? And they had a debate on for and against, and the against were really, you know, quite seriously engaged with the Quran and religious teachings, and felt very, very strongly on the subject of gay marriage. We had 300 16 and 17 year olds in the room having this debate. We had an hour and a half debate, and it was every moment of that debate was conducted with courtesy and humour. There was a great deal of laughter in the room. It was a very, very constructive debate. They had a vote, and the vote went in favour of permitting gay marriage. And I just, you know, for me, this is just an example of the kinds of things that go on in schools and institutions that, if you just listen to what's been happening in the Trojan horse debate, you would never have an idea that these things are happening. Doesn't mean we don't have many and diverse problems and challenges to face. We absolutely do, as Trevor's said. But I think working from the neighbourhoods up, working from the schools up, there is a great deal that we can do. And the big challenge for me is housing.
Okay. Thanks a lot. First of all, can we just...